This is Car Expert.
Golf GDI, it absolutely carries some pace through corners and confidently so.
Kia and Hyundai, although the exterior design is quite different, underneath the cars are quite similar.
They were the best looking minivans of all time.
Just to be clear though, Will, the fact that people have had a lot of sex to need an Odyssey doesn't make the car sexy.
G'day, my name's Mandy Turner. Hello to Scott Colley.
Hello, Mandy.
And William Stopford, hello.
Hello, I'm speaking to you live from a Nissan X-Trail in the Car Expert Experience Centre.
It's actually quite good for acoustics. A very good studio.
Yeah, it's good sound deadening in this. I'm right next to a speaker playing music and you can't hear it.
Can't hear a thing, no.
Which feels like an important
sideways eye roll.
Buyer check, I think. You know, can you record a podcast from directly next to a Sonos speaker playing the top 100?
There we go.
The answer?
I feel like there should be a new Car Expert rating.
It should be a decibel reading for that particular circumstance.
I'm going to speak about this in the news very shortly, Scully, but you have a current favourite or a new favourite car, I should say.
I do. Anyone who knows me, and I know you guys both do, knows that I am a sucker for a Porsche 911, and I'm an especially big sucker for something like a GT3. And then when you take the wings off the GT3, you've just got the perfect car for me. So there's a new 911 GT3 Touring out, and it's a 911 GT3 with the wings taken off, a bit more leather on the inside, and the option of a manual gearbox, although you can get an auto this time around. And it just looks and sounds and seems perfect to me on paper.
I think the GT3 Touring is probably one of the best ones you can get.
I think so too. There's just something so, like, it's got that classic 911 silhouette because there's no wings on it, but it also is big and muscular at the back, and the engine sounds incredible based on the GT3 as well. So it just ticks so many boxes. I'm just going to need to borrow like 370 grand from someone. So yeah, if anyone does have that handy, send an email to scottscarfund@carexpert.com.au.
No, this is not a real email address.
Speaking of 911, Scully, my favourite in the current lineup is actually the Targa. And I've never been a fan of the original Targa from the 70s. It just looked a bit strange, too much glass happening. But I feel like the new Targa is probably the best out of all of them. Am I crazy for saying that, or do you like it too?
I think you're kind of on the money. I don't know that if I had the money, it would be the one that I would buy. But for a long time, the Targa was kind of the awkward stepchild in the 911 family. The first one had that really beautiful roll hoop, which was the only way they could sell it as a convertible with American rollover standards, is my understanding. But over the years, it's also been like a weird hard top that's had a sliding kind of sunroof and all sorts of different things. And they finally worked it out with the 991, the previous generation car. And all of a sudden, they've given it the roll hoop. It's got that classic glass sort of rear. And then when you open the roof, the whole glass rear windscreen lifts up and the roof panel folds in underneath it. And it's completely wild and over the top. It looks ridiculous when it's happening, but it's really, really cool. And it's kind of given the Targa a point of difference. So it's not the one I would buy, but I can understand why you would.
Do you like 911s, Will? I know you're a bit of like an American car guy, but
I can appreciate a fine piece of German engineering just like anybody else. And yes, good man. Absolutely.
All right, news time. Now, this is the car that we were just talking about in the intro. The 911 GT3 70 years Porsche Australia edition has been revealed. Oh, it's sexy.
Oh, it sure is. I know you love a 356, Mandy. This is actually a special edition just for Australia. About 25 of them are going to be built, and it's not cheap. It's nudging $500,000, but it's based on the GT3 Touring. And what Porsche's done, and this is actually part of a process between Porsche Australia, Porsche Individual Manufacturer, and Porsche Special Projects, they only do two of these a year, is they've actually lent on the first 356 imported to Australia for inspiration. So the colour you see on the GT3 Touring pictured in our story on Car Expert looks like a normal silver, but it's actually called Fish Silver Grey Metallic, and it's a modern interpretation of the colour painted to one of the first two 356s in Australia. It's initially going to be exclusive to this car, and it'll eventually be added to the very expensive Porsche individual palette. But all throughout the car, there are these really unique touches that just make it a little bit special. So it's got that fish silver grey metallic exterior, and there's that same colour highlighted around the outside of the wheels. There's a badge on the B pillar, that says, with an Australian flag saying 70 years edition. And then you look at the interior, and it's got blue leather bucket seats with tartan trim in the middle. It's actually the first GT3 base special to not have black leather. And there's crayon stitching throughout it. It's just beautiful. I know I sound like just a hopeless Porsche fan there, and that's because I am, but it's really, really gorgeous and really nicely thought out. And when we got to sit down with a man called Boris Eppenbrink, who is the head of Porsche Exclusive, we also spoke to the head of purchase of motorsport and sales for Porsche Australia. And then we spoke to Grant Larson, who is the director of Porsche Special Projects. And the process they went through to actually make this paint, for one, was really quite exacting. Each car gets its own bucket, and they had to try and bring it from what was a chemical color into a water-based color because they're cleaner and that's what they use in 2021. It was really quite an involved process. This is the first ever market special based on a motorsports car. So all the rest have been on 911s or Macans, but none of them on GT cars. There's just lots of really cool little details about it that make it feel a bit special and a bit nicer than the average special edition, because every brand these days has a black edition or a white edition or a red edition, or it depends on what day of the week it is. But the amount of thought that's gone into this and the little details that go through this car, I know I'm a hopeless Porsche fan, but I think elevated above even some of the other Porsche special editions we've seen.
So do you reckon it's worth the price hike from the standard touring to this special edition?
I mean, to 25 people, I have no doubt it will be. We've said in our story that you need to start whispering sweet nothings or threatening unspeakable things to your Porsche Center to get one. And that is really how you're going to have to go about getting it. I think I was speccing the car, my GT3 touring, when my lottery numbers come up, might look a little bit different, but it's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous. And there's a really cool story behind it.
Yeah. What color would you have yours?
I think I'd have mine in a sort of, they call it gentian blue metallic. And then you'd have the goldy, bronzy wheels on there and the black package. Not that I've thought about this much.
I'm going to be boring. I actually like the white.
I can see that. It's a purist spec.
It is. Okay, Will, Volkswagen are having some supply issues with the moment.
Well, look, everybody is, to be fair.
True.
But Volkswagen's actually put out a press release earlier this week just to say, hey, just giving you an update, these are the vehicles we're experiencing supply issues with. It's a good chunk of them, but they've also helpfully included like which variants are experiencing shortages. So as you would be aware, there's a global semiconductor shortage. There's a lot of parts and a lot of modern cars that require semiconductors. Volkswagen has also said they've had other supply issues, including with some of their older products. So its best-selling model at the moment, the Amarok, has been affected by logistical delays, but the company says there will be strong arrivals late this
month
and early next month.
Lots of air quotation marks happening here. You can't see it, but we can.
Yeah, exactly. So the semiconductor shortage has affected two key launches for 2021. So as we know, there's a redesigned Golf that's just come out, and there's an updated version of the Tiguan. So Volkswagen has specifically said that the semiconductors required for the dual-clutch automatic transmission in the GTI and the optional Harman Kardon sound system that's available across almost all the Golf range means there's been a slowdown in production with those models. Tiguan models in R-line trim are being affected as well. It's also unrelated to semiconductors, I should think, is a lack of the leather upholstery used in these models.
Oh, yes. Are there lack of cows in the world? Why?
Yeah. Well. semiconductor shortages have also affected the Touareg 210 TDI because of its big Innovision digital cockpit. And the company has also said that it's just issues getting supply of its T6.1 range of vans and the Crafter 35. But if you are in the market for a Polo, T-Cross, T-Roc, Tiguan that's not an R-Line, an All-Space, Passat, Arteon, or Caddy, you're fine. There's no specific supply issues at the moment for those models. They also said Skoda Octavia, stock shortfalls. They're directing customers to the stock locator tool on the Skoda website. So Volkswagen's basically, they've resisted the temptation to remove or substitute features that require more semiconductors. So it's something we've started to see in the industry as a whole. It hasn't affected that I can think of any models that have been sold in Australia, but the Peugeot 308, for example, the outgoing model, because we know there's a new one on the way, was supposed to get a digital instrument cluster in Europe, but they've just decided not to implement that, so they can, I guess, save some semiconductor chips. And GM's actually removed automatic stop-start from some of its full-sized SUVs and pickup trucks in North America.
I believe in Australia, Mercedes-Benz has been impacted. There's some features have been removed from A-class-based models. I think not, you know, life and death stuff, but there are some small tweaks to the spec of those cars, is my understanding.
Gotcha.
I just picture the situation at factories around the world at the moment, like that dog sitting in a fiery room meme that goes around, which I know this is an obscure reference, yes. But all the car makers are running around like crazy trying to get these semiconductors, and a lot of it's on the back of COVID, because car makers dropped their orders on the back of lower production, and the world's electronics manufacturers went, great, we'll have those, thanks. And because car makers aren't the biggest customers for these suppliers, they're not, you know, ramping up production again for them, or there's not enough to go around. But yeah, being a car maker and being an importer in Australia, which is quite a small market for a lot of brands as well, must be such a headache at the moment, because you just cannot get any of the things you need. And then in the case of the Amarok, sometimes when you do get them here, you can't actually get them into the country when you want, or the boat gets held up, or there's just so many things that can go wrong, and it seems like all of them are going wrong at the moment.
It makes me wonder how many different places semiconductor chips come from, because it reminds me of, do you remember that James Bond film from the 80s, A View to a Kill? And Christopher Walken's character, is his evil plan is to actually start an earthquake to flood Silicon Valley so that he can, he'll basically have a monopoly on the microchip market. So I don't know if there's a real Max Zorin out there who's wreaking havoc in the global industry, but.
If I had to guess what happens in that movie, James Bond foils the plot and has casual sex with someone attractive, is that what happens from there? Wow.
with the late Tanya Roberts, may she rest in peace.
There you go.
And you know what, Roger Moore hated that film, and a lot of people did, but it's one of my favorite Bond films, so
William Stopford on why he has no taste, folks.
You sound just like James Wong. Get out.
Oh god. Well, speaking of taste, I think everyone loves this next car, Singer. Oh, it's coming to Australia, Scully, and I am so incredibly excited to see these on local roads.
I am too. I realise this week I've just turned into car expert's niche Porsche correspondent, but Singer, which is a Californian company that takes old 964, 911 body shells and reimagines them, is the word they use, has been around for just over 10 years, I believe, now in California and selling cars to Europe. But they haven't been in Australia and New Zealand. That's about to change through a partnership with Zagami, which is a massive dealership group in Australia that looks after all sorts of special stuff, from, you know, mainstream things like Ferrari, McLaren, Lamborghini, all the way through to Pagani. They're also going to be looking after Singer and giving people a place they can go to spec these cars, to get them serviced and maintained, and to, you know, keep track of the logistics as they're being built. The first cars are already on the roads in New Zealand. So the car pictured in our story is a beautiful olive green 964. It's got an air-cooled 3.8-litre engine, but Singer does everything from like fairly sympathetic restorations to those engines all the way through to these incredible, what they call dynamic lightweighting studies with Cosworth engines, so you can have pretty much anything.
Is that an unsympathetic restoration then?
Well, it's less historically accurate would probably be how I'd put it. I personally feel sympathetic to anyone who doesn't go the whole way with these things, because they cost at least $700,000 is our understanding, and up from there. So you might as well do it properly. But yeah, each of these commissions is completely bespoke to what the owner wants. And if you check out the Singer website, each of them is a completely different color. They can do Targas and convertibles and coupes and all-wheel drive, and one of the things they mentioned in the press release and in our conversations with them is they can do ski racks and spotlights. So I personally love the idea of a winter ski field spec 911, provided your wallet is deep enough and you've got enough time to wait, because waiting lists overseas are up to 3 years is our understanding.
Wow.
You can get pretty much anything done. And I don't know, I love the GT3 Touring, but if you really want to stand out, a Singer in a nice spec might just be the way to do it.
Oh, yeah. So the price tag you said, is that priced in the US, or we do not have prices for Australia yet?
There's no prices for any of these cars, because they are all so bespoke and they are all built by quite a small team in a factory in California. So it's not like there's a list price. You've got to source the car yourself first, is my understanding, although I think if you pay Singer, they'll find one for you. And then once you've found the donor car, you can go through and have pretty much anything done. There's some incredible interviews and videos that Singer has done speaking with other outlets and other people online about their process. And, you know, you can have everything from a track spec car with a stripped out interior to one that has sound deadening that's been developed by the people who do sound deadening for G6 private jets. So there really is a pretty big price range, and there's a huge array of things you can get done. So to quote a price would be a little bit irresponsible. It also might make our listeners faint while they're driving or something. So it feels a little bit irresponsible in that sense as well. Because, yeah, you're looking
at... If you have to ask, you can't afford, sir.
Yes.
Exactly, yeah. But yeah. It doesn't hurt to dream.
Dark purple with gold rims, please.
Oh. I think that already exists. I think there's one of those out there already, but it does look sexy.
Because I loved it. I fell in love with it. So, yes, I would. There would be two of them in the world then, maybe. and lastly, Will, we're saying goodbye to the Honda Odyssey.
Yes, well, Honda Australia has said that we're going to continue to get the Odyssey until the end of its current life cycle. So our Odyssey is currently sourced from Japan, and the factory that is manufacturing it is being closed. Honda announced that a few years ago, but the Sayama assembly plant manufactures the Odyssey. It manufactures the Legend, which we haven't gotten here since the previous generation. It also manufactures the Clarity plug-in hybrid and hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. Now, none of those are massive sellers. That's especially true for the Legend and the Clarity. But effectively, there's a report out of from Nikkei Asia saying that production of the Odyssey won't be moved to another Japanese factory. So that kind of leaves us with nothing, because this current Odyssey was first previewed back in 2013, went on sale here in 2014. So it's towards the end of its life cycle anyway. It's also manufactured in China, but we don't get any Hondas from China. In fact, most of our Hondas come from Thailand, with a few exceptions, the Odyssey being one of them. So it seems this, we haven't heard anything about a replacement Odyssey. Now, the Odyssey that's sold in Asia Pacific markets is different from the one that's sold in North America. So the two Odysseys just kind of diverged with the third generation model. So the American one got ever bigger, had V6 engines. We had that, and I'm going to say it, the sexy third and fourth generation Odysseys, which did not look like minivans. They were the best looking minivans of all time.
Just to be clear though, Will, the fact that people have like had a lot of sex to need an Odyssey doesn't make the car sexy.
I just thought, I remember seeing, like, you know, when the third generation models came out, and I'm like, you know what, if Honda did a Type R version of this,
oh my god,
yeah, I would have been like, yeah, okay, all right, cool.
Fast and Furious 5, the fast and fertile.
Oh, well, so practical. I mean, Mercedes did an AMG version of its R-Class, so come on.
And that sold in huge numbers. They sold 6 globally.
It was actually very close to that. But, yeah, so with the current generation of Odyssey, as we know, it adopted sliding doors for the first time with the Asia-Pacific market Odyssey. It got a little bit taller. It got, you know, frumpy. They facelifted it quite recently, gave it quite a good-looking update. Standard active safety technology across the range literally just went on sale, and then we get this news that, oh, well, sorry, Odyssey's going soon. So we'll stay tuned. As we know, Honda has been trimming its range locally, so they opted not to bring in the new generation Jazz. The City Sedan is gone. The NSX, which sold a you know, in similar numbers to the Mercedes R63 AMG, it's gone.
Maybe so, the brand might be looking at just going SUV only, like a lot of others are.
Well, they've committed to the Civic. So the new Civic will come here only in hatch. That does mean that we're still getting the Type R, which is wonderful news. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of, whenever we post an article on our website about Honda, there's a lot of doom and gloom in the comments, like, oh, why doesn't Honda just pack up? And what are they doing? Blah, blah, blah. But I think Honda has never been as, and I know we think of the glory days when they had, you know, Accord Euro, and they had a really wide range of models. Early 2000s was maybe peak Honda in Australia in terms of desirability. I mean, you might have a different opinion there. But I think Honda's always been a bit of a smaller player than a lot of the other Japanese brands. So, for example, Mitsubishi is disproportionately popular here compared to other markets outside the Asia-Pacific region where it doesn't do so hot. Mazda does really well here as well. But Honda's always been a bit of a smaller player. They didn't produce cars locally. So I think Honda's just kind of trimming. They're focusing on core models. We'll see if the Accord sticks around, because that's a midsize sedan and everyone seems to be leaving that segment. But yeah, Honda's basically committing to, you know, your key Civic, CRV, HRV. They're switching to this agency sales model. So it's going to be a very tailored range, a smaller dealership network. Yes, smaller sales overall. I think we've already started seeing that. Sales have been declining. But I don't necessarily mean this portends any, you know, leaving of Honda. That's a really poor wording. I use a fancy word like portend and then I say any leaving. But you know what I mean? Like, I think Honda will probably stick around. We're just not a massive market in terms of priority. Although I'd like to remind people of this. The number two brand in China is Honda. So they are a big company. They know what they're doing. And I think that they're just kind of just maybe trimming the fat here and just kind of downsizing and being a little bit more focused. And unfortunately, that does mean the Kia Carnival's kind of chief competition is potentially going.
Just to be clear, we also don't know if Honda is working on plans for a Thai-built successor, whether Honda USA might start manufacturing cars in right-hand drive for us, which opens all sorts of doors as well. So
fingers crossed.
Obviously, this is all speculation. We don't know what's going to happen, but at the moment, it doesn't look great for the Odyssey, does it?
No, it doesn't. And look, bringing the big US Odyssey, which is a larger vehicle, that would be good. But I think if Honda could get its hands on any US-built models, that three-row pilot SUV would be the very top of their list. I think Honda Australia, you know, if I can speculate here, has been wanting that since the very first generation model was launched years ago. If they could get their hands on that, it'd be like, what Odyssey?
Well, if you'd like to know more, click the car news link at carexpert.com.au. Hello, Tony Crawford.
Hey, Mandy, how are you? Oh. And you have my dearest colleagues, Will Stopford, who was sitting in a car in the Experience Centre.
We actually are going to kill two birds with one stone while we've got you on here, Crawford. I cannot wait to hear your thoughts. You've been driving a brand new Volkswagen Golf GTI. And, Will, you've been driving the Golf Life, which is the second one up in the variants. Let's start with the GTI, because that's the most popular Golf in Australia. So first thoughts, Crawf, when you got in.
First thoughts. Okay, so I arrived this morning at 11 a.m. at Ludnam Raceway, which is a very small track out the southwest of Sydney. It's perfect for a hot hatch, if not perhaps a little bit too small. So Golf GTI, well, you know, after getting out of the Life and taking the Life there and doing a swap at the track, firstly, I like the look of Mark 8 Golf. I like the edginess to it. I like the new lights. I like the fact that it's the GTI, at least, has got a little longer rear spoiler at the top, the roof spoiler. And that kind of makes it look really quite kind of swoopy, if you like. But, you know, everyone's talking about – I read a couple of reviews in Europe that said, oh, you know, it's boring. It's – you know, what they fail to realize is that this is the eighth generation. And like the 911, you know, things move very slowly and changes happen very slowly. And there's a good reason for that, because these cars have sold in huge numbers globally for eight generations and similar with the 911. And there's a reason for that. You don't piss people off by changing the shape dramatically like other manufacturers and wonder why your sales go up and down like a yo-yo, and why Volkswagen has remained consistent with the Golf, and particularly the Golf GTI, because, as you know, we were just discussing, it is expensive, though. Let me just digress for a minute. $53,100 plus on roads plus options. And that's a lot of – that's $6,100 odd more than the last GDI performance. So we're talking about a big increase here, particularly dangerous when you've got i30N dual clutch coming out later in the year. And I think that is starting at 44 grand, going up to about 52.
So the most expensive i30N dual clutch with a sunroof and the premium interior is 52 before on roads. So with no option, sorry, with all the options and a DCT, the most expensive i30N is less expensive than the entry-level Golf GTI.
Wow. Yeah, that's a big call, but I've driven that it might have had some iteration and some changes and some calibration work done to it, but I drove that i30N on track probably half a year ago now. And, they're very hard riding. They're harder riding than other cars, even though they're adaptive suspension. Of course, the Golf GDI is also has adaptive dampers in the system. Now, a couple of things on Golf GDI. It's actually slower than the previous 7.5 GDI, which is quite remarkable. It's 1/10 slower. So it's the new car is 6.3 0 to 100. The old car is 6.2. Now, this is extraordinary. And I started to think, oh, gee, this is a bit of a bummer, isn't it? But, okay, so it's not really when you think about it because, I mean, we're all caught up in the 0 to 100s. A lot of people are. I'm not. If there's anything I want in a car more than 0 to 100, it's driver feel and it's feedback to the driver to make the car enjoyable as it goes around a corner. And that's what this one, they've nailed it on this. So this is a whole different ball game in terms of the front end. For a start, we've gone from a steel front subframe to an aluminium subframe, which is stronger as well because you never found the limit in the old one because you couldn't get there because it wasn't strong enough. So there was twist. There's no twist in this one. It absolutely carries some pace through corners and confidently so from the very first time you get in. So I think people are going to have a lot of fun in this car. It's the same engine, of course. They have tweaked the throttle response, they tell us, slightly, and I get that. So it drags you out of a corner a little bit quicker, in my mind. And, of course, with that front end and the diff lock, the e-diff, and you've got a new variable dynamic management tool that you never had before as well in the old one that marries everything together in terms of traction and that diff, that locking diff. And so I found you could actually overcook a corner this morning and, there's no torque steer. There's none. I don't know where that's gone, but it's completely disappeared out of Golf GDI. It just got quicker and quicker as you went round on the 18-inch wheels, Potenza tyres. They're not specifying a particular type of tyre, which was really interesting. They were using Goodyears and Potenzas, Bridgestone Potenzas. I'd probably, if that's the fact and there's no stipulation, I'd probably go Michelin 4S, but that's me. So, I like that tyre,
So, Crawf, there's no manual option, which was previously the case as well with the GTI. Do you feel like you're missing out on much by being DSG only? And has the DSG changed all that much compared to the last one?
No, I don't believe it's changed much at all. It's still the 7-speed dual clutch that I think it was because it's the same engine, in fact, because we don't have the particulate filter that the Europeans have. So we have the same engine that was in the 7.5, same outputs, 180 and 370, and, of course, just a little bit slower. Don't know why that is, but, it's not important because this car, we'll have a lot more fun going through chicanes, roundabouts, and certainly on track. It was very forgiving. By all means, push the living crap out of this car because you can. And it will allow you to do so. And it feels very, very sorted. Like everything's talking to everything is in sync in this car from steering to suspension. And it's a big difference, by the way, with that adaptive dampers on the GDI between comfort and sport. Huge difference, in fact. Then they've got the breadth right. So I drove back home in comfort. And the other thing is that you can dial the damping way down 15 levels, I believe, in the individual settings, which is really interesting. So you can change it up. And I tried to do that. It was just a little bit hard with that new on-screen system. So there's no buttons, of course. And I think a few people have whinged about that. I certainly was having difficulty finding the menu that turns the lane change assist off. And I found it in the end. And of course, it's always the way when you own a car, you're going to sit down, you're going to fiddle with everything, you're going to get it all sorted within a half an hour, and then you'll never have to go back and check any manual or whatever. But it's just not intuitive when you first get in, if I can say that.
So, Will, I've experienced Volkswagen's new gen interior in the Skoda Octavia in the base model, not the really high-end flashy one, and I found it a little bit confusing. Does that also carry over to the new Golf?
Look, we were actually talking about this earlier because, you know, if you want to do something as simple as adjust the fan speed of the air conditioning, you have to go into the special, like, climate menu. There's not just a knob that you can twist. So Volkswagen has put these touch controls throughout the interior, and I'm talking even the headlight switches to the right-hand side of the steering wheel. They're all just touch controls. The overhead lights, they're all controlled with touch controls, none of which have haptic feedback. Now, the advantage of switching to this is, I presume it might be cheaper for Volkswagen, but also it gives you this very clean look. So the cabin looks really nice and modern and simple and kind of minimalist, but it does mean that things are just a little bit more frustrating to do. If you want to adjust the temperature, you just press this kind of slider thing, but you can easily accidentally set off the slider when you're just trying to use the touchscreen. Then you don't have actual physical switches for, as Tony said, things like lane keep assist, which you have to go into a menu for. So yes, you're absolutely right, Tony. People are going to get used to that when they own it. But things that you used to be able to do just by touch, without even looking, it's like, that's the button, that's the knob. You're now having to press a button, press something on the touchscreen, and that just makes it so much more distracting when you're driving. We already have so many distractions when we're driving with smartphone mirroring and things like that. And I think putting so much stuff in the touchscreen is just a recipe for even more distraction.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how many of those features you can access by voice control on the steering. I did try to I tried a few orders on voice control. It didn't work for me, but I probably was using it incorrectly. But
that's what companies say, right? They say, oh, yes, but you can do more and more. Like Mercedes-Benz has said this, you can do more and more with voice prompts. But how often do you want to do that? Like, I find when I'm using, you know, Apple and Android devices and I'm trying to use voice prompts, they don't always get it right. And these are actually smartphone companies. So you can only imagine what a car company is managing to create with its technology.
I can't go. Number of times I've tried to use vehicle voice control and said something as simple as like set the radio to triple J, and instead it's come back with draining bank account and deflating tires. You go, how did you get there? What are you doing? Yeah. So relying on that sort of thing, and also relying on software updates, which is something that a few car makers have said will happen as they try to refine them. It's just a game that it may pay off in the long term and they may work it out, but it does feel like you're taking a bit of a gamble early on.
But look, it on track, it does feel incredibly well balanced, much better than the previous car to my mind. The spring rates have been increased up front 5%, in the rear 15%. So combine that with the stiffer front end, front subframe, and you've got a recipe for some really good cornering fun. And don't be afraid to take this car on track. Golf GDIs have never worked for me on track. They've always been way too soft. But this car is different, and I think that's the big plus.
Would you buy one?
Yeah, I'd buy one because I do like the i30N. It's very quick on track, but it, you know what? As I said, Golf GDI has always done one thing better than anyone, and that's provide a fun, high performance daily. And that's what they continue to do because the ride comfort is exceptional. I don't think, I mean, even though the i30N has, and, you know, I keep saying the i30N because these are the arch rivals now, I think. They're going to get into it. They're going to mix it up when that thing comes out, and there's going to be a lot of comparisons, a lot of, you know, acceleration tests, which the i30 will win, of course. because that's 5.9. But people, fellow enthusiasts, don't let that stop you going and test driving and therefore buying the Golf. I think the only thing that might stop you is, of course, the price increase. That's quite sizable, and as Scully said, you can buy the entry level, the Golf or the top spec i30N with paddles for cheaper than you can buy $1,000 cheaper or more than the Golf GDI, base Golf GDI. So I don't know. They may be thinking they're going to do some more with this chassis. Because it has a lot more stiffness and maybe can take even more grunt. So, maybe there's something club sport around the corner or some beefier Golf GDIs, some limited edition stuff. I don't know. Like it's interesting. This car is, I won't say it's a game changer, but it's certainly a big step up in the handling department and ride control and composure than the previous car.
Well, there you go. If you would like to read Croft's review, it is live now at carexpert.com.au. Thank you, Croft.
Thank you, guys.
So GTI aside, let's focus on the Golf life. Will, you had quite a good stint behind the wheel of this. What were your thoughts?
No, I really liked it. I think one of the kind of key changes here, besides the touch controls that we've already touched on, is the shift from a dual clutch automatic to an 8-speed torque converter automatic for the core Golf range, which now consists of Golf, Golf Life, and Golf R line. I don't think switching to a torque converter is necessarily a bad thing. I think you might notice it coming out of a Mark 7.5 Golf or coming out of another Volkswagen product. But I don't think it's any the worse for adopting a torque converter. And I think that it actually pays some dividends in terms of kind of low speed smoothness. And I know there's going to be a bunch of dual clutch enthusiasts like James Wong saying, well, you need to change your driving style. Whereas with a torque converter, you can just slam your foot to the ground and drive it like that. But look, I think it drives really well, and I was just impressed by, as you would expect, the level of polish it just kind of exudes everywhere in its on-road dynamics, in the way its interior is put together. It just feels like a classy car. Now, it is a little bit more expensive compared to its predecessor, but Volkswagen has added its huge range of IQ drive active safety and driver assist features across the range. You've also got that Trick digital instrument cluster, which not many rivals in this segment can boast. I can't think of any off the top of my head other than top spec versions of i30 sedan. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the interior is classy. Yes, the touch controls are a pain, but it is a nice car. And I think it has a little bit more polish than some other cars in the segment. And that turbocharged engine, I think it's kind of a funny test, right? Like sometimes you and I, Scott, we drive all different cars in this job, and it's not like every single car you get in and think, I could see myself owning this, because we drive all manner of vehicles. But I'm driving around this Golf and I'm thinking, you know what? I might be a big rear wheel drive sedan man, but I could get used to having one of these.
Well, that's always been the appeal of the Golf, hasn't it? It's sort of a timeless and ageless and maybe a bit over the top, but it's an ego-free kind of category-free car that suits a lot of people, which is why everyone from grandmas to, teenage girls buying their first car want one.
Yes.
And I think that even the new model, although it doesn't, like the new interior, I haven't sat in a new Golf. I've driven the Octavia with the same, a variation of the same cabin. It frustrated me. And I do think that the simplicity of the Mark 7.5 is going to be missed. But it does seem like Volkswagen has just nailed down on, what people really liked about the last one. And that was the fact that the engine is super smooth and punchy for the money you pay. Even at 32, 33 grand for a base model with an automatic, you're still getting what is arguably the best engine in that segment before you get into the performance stuff. And now it's got a torque converter, which from a pure technical standpoint is a step backwards from the DSG, and some people are really going to be upset about. it's also going to make the car feel more natural to a lot of people and remove one of the last hurdles to owning a Golf that some people had. It really doesn't do much to undermine those credentials as the ultimate all-rounder. I do think Volkswagen has missed a trick by not having a properly cheap one, because at $29,990 for a manual before on-road costs, the least people are going to pay for this car is about $35,000 drive away. And given you can get into a Hyundai i30 with a lot of kit for that sort of money, the new Kia Cerato is similar. It does seem like Volkswagen's maybe just missing out a little bit, but you know, I'm also not a product planner, and it might be down to the fact Volkswagen can't get one cheap enough. It might be down to the fact they think they can't sell it. But yeah, the new Golf doesn't seem to do much to undermine the appeal of the older ones.
I think you touched on something on something there as well, and Croft did earlier, that this in Europe, this is seen as kind of a, and this is not derogatory, but a classless car. People from all different kind of levels of income can drive this, and it's not seen as being like a lesser car. It's just almost exists in like a vacuum. And I think part of that is, as Tony was saying before, every Golf has just been a real evolution stylistically, and Volkswagen's never really tried to do any crazy risks. But the flip side of that is, design wise, they've never succumbed to fashion trends that have quickly become passé. So I remember, you know, reading some of the first coverage and seeing photos of the Golf market, and I'm like, oh, well, this, you know, a lot of people were complaining that it looked quite different, and that it didn't look as attractive, and it did this, it did that. And when you actually look at one in person, frankly, it's just as evolutionary in design as every Golf that has come before it. From behind, I mean, Mark 7.5 and Mark 8 look especially similar. Now the Mark 7.5, I will say, is probably one of my favorite Golfs. It's a timeless design. It looks great. And I think a lot of people are going to miss that. I think perhaps the criticism that I have about the Golf are those touch controls. Now, I got used to them. The interior looks great. The interior is of nice quality as well. But you know, a lot of Golf buyers are older buyers. That's not to say it's an old person's car, not by any stretch. But I think, you know, certain parts of the driving population are not going to be happy with the switch to those controls. That aside, this is a great car, and I think it's a worthy redesign.
One of the most popular large SUVs in Australia, the 2021 Toyota Kluger, is out roaming the streets, and Mike Costello has had the chance to drive one of the specs of the Kluger. Hello, Moko.
G'day, guys. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Which one of the Klugers did you drive, and has there been much change between the current and the previous model?
Right, it's been a bit of a long time coming, hasn't it? We saw this new Kluger revealed in the States more than a year ago now. It's taken a heck of a long time to make it here. We had the top-of-the-range Grande in the new hybrid incarnation, the petrol-electric hybrid incarnation, so the absolute top-of-the-pops model. And look, this is not some sort of mid-cycle update. This is an entirely new car. It's a new platform, new drivetrains, interiors, sheet metal. I doubt there's so much as a nut or a bolt carried over on this hybrid example compared to the previous car. So a complete redo. And given that the Kluger is far and away the most popular three-row crossover SUV in the country, a new one is massive news. And I think it's probably going to terrify the likes of the Mazda CX-9, Kia Sorento, and Hyundai Santa Fe and Palisade.
Mm. How do all those stack up price-wise? Where does it sit?
It's a bit X-y, this new Kluger, I got to say. So the base model is $47,650 before on roads, which equates to $52,500 drive away. But by the time you hit the Grande spec level and you add the all-wheel drive and you add that new hybrid engine, you're looking at $75,400 list price, which is $82,900 drive away. That's a heck of a lot more than something like a top of the range CX-9, which is 73.5, a top of the range Santa Fe is 70.5, and a top of the range Sportage GT line is 67, and they're all drive away prices, by the way. The only, I guess, mainstream product of similar size and price is the very American centric Hyundai Palisade Highlander in diesel guise, which is $82,000. So Toyota always charges a slight premium for its products, and the new Kluger is no exception.
I was going to ask about the Palisade because the previous Kluger was big relative to the Sorento and to the Santa Fe. Does this model on paper stack up more closely to a Palisade, or is it more like a current Sorento, Hyundai Santa Fe, Mazda CX-9?
Well, the Palisade's the deceptive one, actually, because this model's only a little bit bigger than its predecessor, Kluger. It's minutely bigger in all dimensions, but it's actually more or less the same size as a Palisade. So the Palisade has that big yank tank design language, but it's actually not the 6 meter long behemoth that its design leads you to believe. It's just under 5 meters long, as is the Kluger. So it's dimensionally very, very similar vehicles.
Does it feel big to drive?
It does. It feels like a, you know, just like a CX-9 would. These are 5 meter long three row SUVs, but like a lot of the new Toyota products, and then this migrates across to the ubiquitous TNGA Toyota Global Architecture System, which underpins basically all of its new vehicles now, it's a lot better to drive than before. So the old Kluger was a little bit rough around the edges. You know, it rode nicely, but it was a bit of a sort of wallowy beast in the corners, whereas this new one is a bit more agile, a bit more tied down. I thought on the 20-inch wheels that the Grande had, the ride was a little bit jittery and thumpy over expansion joints and things like that, but entirely reasonable, good NVH suppression, so nice and quiet. Definitely a step up over the old one, and, you know, these are soccer mum duty SUVs or soccer dad duty SUVs, and they need to be good in town, and look, it's fine.
The hybrid has been a revelation in the RAV4. It's dominating sales in the Camry range. How does the Kluger hybrid stack up compared to the V6? Because this is a very different car to both of them.
Yeah, so the Kluger's always run a big thirsty V6, and the new one has that option, but it also has the hybrid option now. And yeah, as you said, mate, we've seen hybrids explode in popularity lately. About 20% of all Toyotas sold are hybrids now, and it's well over half of all the RAV4s sold. I think actually more like 65% are hybrids. It's also the majority drivetrain choice in, you know, CHR and Corolla and Camry. So this is mainstream tech now, and it really suits a car like the Kluger that's designed for family getaways, but a lot of driving around town, going to the shops, going on the school runs and things like that. Similar efficiency to the sort of diesel engines that you might get in a Santa Fe or a Sorento, but much more refined and quiet and capable of electric propulsion at low speeds. So definitely is a massive addition into the Kluger. Fuel efficiency is really good. So I average 6.5 litres every 100 Ks, which for a car that's this big is entirely reasonable. It's very similar to what you get in a diesel. I don't think it quite has the pep that you might get in the RAV4. The 3-motor system and power outputs are decent on paper, but it's sort of still a 9 second to 100 car. So it's not a rocket ship. But around town in stop-start driving, it's super smooth, super silent, very, very, very refined, kind of what you're looking for. It's only when you're really up it or you're carrying a full load that you notice a little bit of, you know, refinement issues starting to creep in.
So this might not apply to a lot of Kluger buyers or a lot of large crossover buyers, but how does it stack up in terms of towing ability in the hybrid? And how is third row room for children and for adults?
Great questions, Will. So towing capacity is rated at 2,000 kilograms, which is pretty reasonable, really. We know that hybrids traditionally weren't great at towing, but that technology continues to evolve. Probably not quite as good at towing as what a diesel would be. So if you are going to tow that family caravan around, I'd probably still be encouraging someone to buy a diesel 3-row SUV for this kind of thing, but certainly respectable. And then the 3-row room, not bad. Probably more kid-friendly. I'm nearly 2 metres tall, so I certainly don't have the space, but I wouldn't expect it to accommodate someone of my dimensions. So the access points are fine. It's a really clever mechanism where there's one simple movement, pulling a lever, and it tilts and slides the second row seat forwards. And, you know, grumpy teenagers will begrudgingly sit in there, and kids will happily fit in there without any dramas. And there's room for a big suitcase behind the third row seats, even when they're deployed too. So while it's not exactly a Kia Carnival in terms of dimensions, it's certainly still that friendly 5+2 thing that it always was.
These big family haulers have turned into kind of tech flagships when you look at the Santa Fe and the Sorento and even the Palisade to a lesser extent. Are there enough USB ports in the Kluger to charge everyone's devices, and how does the tech stack up?
It doesn't have the full suite of 8 USBs that the Palisade famously claims. I think that's its claim, isn't it? So the tech side of things, you know, there are USB points in the middle row, and it does have vents in the roof running all the way back. And it's relatively well furnished with the latest active safety technologies, but it doesn't have the incredibly interesting, you know, 10-plus inch screen that you're getting in the Korean stuff these days. Even the new Mazda CX-9 just got an infotainment update. And the Kluger does feel a bit dated in that regard. The 8-inch center touchscreen, you know, it has most of the core functionality. They've embraced phone mirroring now. It has sat-nav. But, you know, it's a fairly stripped-back basic system for what is an $80,000-plus, you know, kind of luxurious SUV. It doesn't feel like a tech showcase by any means. There aren't, you know, screens in the back of the headrests in the back or anything of that nature. So I'd say if, you know, if we're looking at weaknesses of this car, and it is a good car, but if we're looking at weaknesses, interior tech is definitely one of them.
Well, speaking of the interior, you mentioned like it is a fairly luxurious car. Does luxury match up with the quality of the interior?
I mean, it's a great quality interior in terms of the typical Toyota-ness of it. So the leather feels hard wearing. All of the knobs and dials and things are nicely put together. It's definitely built to handle the kind of abuse that kids can throw at family cars. It's not a luxury car. It doesn't have that sort of Mazda sort of real sumptuous Napa leather-lined feel that you get, and it doesn't have the super high glitzy tech and fancy ambient lighting of the Koreans, but it does have a real kind of solidity to it, and it's very practical as well. So a massive center console, great storage nooks running all along the lower side of the dash. You know, the seats fold into a mini configuration. So it's more of a kind of well-made premium but practical experience than what I'd consider a luxurious one.
It's interesting because it's an 8-inch unit here, but that's only the standard unit in the US where it's sold as the Highlander. There's actually an available 12.3-inch touchscreen on higher grades that we seem to miss out on.
Disappointing. We had a similar thing happen when the CHR launched, which has been rectified since. But we do see sometimes, you know, infotainment systems that come to Australia not being the superior ones. I think in this instance, it's probably a case of sourcing. So we know the Kluger is made in the US. We know that that factory is predominantly focused on the domestic left-hand drive market, which is why it took so long to get to Australia. And I suspect that probably plays a role where the American market has gone, we'll shotgun the good infotainment screen and little old Australia can have the older unit, which does the job. But like you correctly said, it's not exactly Hollywood either.
All right, that sounds like a bit of a wrap there. You can search Toyota Kluger at carexpert.com.au. Thank you, Mike Costello.
Pleasure as always, guys.
Time for an interesting discussion with one of my favourite contributors for Car Expert, Vivek Shah. Hello.
Hi, Mandy. How are you?
Very good, thank you. I always enjoy reading your pieces, and this one in particular was a pretty good read where you put Kia and Hyundai together and sorted out their differences. So I suppose we should start with what exactly do they have in common?
Well, that's a great question. Hyundai and Kia, they're sort of owned by the same what you call chaebol. So chaebol is like a sort of like a historic sort of corporate structure in Korea. It's similar to the Kyoretsu in Japan. And basically, to sum it up, what happens in a chaebol is that there's like a founding family and they sort of own all of the, they have a stake or an ownership stake in all and many different companies. And that sort of ties these companies together. So we have, with Hyundai and Kia in particular, we have Hyundai having an approximately like a 33% to 34% stake in Kia, and then Kia has sort of cross shareholdings in like other Hyundai entities. So they have shareholdings in Hyundai Mobis, which is like a supplier, and then they also have they have an indirect holding in some of the other Hyundai branded entities. So they sort of have a very sort of tight knit relationship, effectively.
So we sort of like to think of Hyundai as Kia's big brother, but it sounds like there's actually a bit more going on there, and Kia owns some of Hyundai as well.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. So they have, you know, they have sort of like a mutually, what I call it, I think the best way to term it is like a mutually beneficial relationship. So Kia has stakes in other Hyundai entities, and Hyundai has like although it is officially only a 33-34% relationship, it is effectively like a very close sort of mutual relationship where Kia and Hyundai, they share a lot of parts, they share a lot of powertrains, and although the exterior design is quite different. The underneath the cars are quite similar. So it's always interesting to see because, you know, we have officially on if you, you know, if you just do a quick sort of Google search, you'll say Hyundai owns a 33% stake in Kia. And then you say, well, what's happening with all the, what? Well, that's just a minority stake. So surely Kia can have independence and do all these other things. But in reality, due to the table nature of the group, they're basically, you know, basically similar companies.
So you've done a lot of stories on platform sharing. How does the way that Hyundai and Kia share technology and platforms differ maybe from a Volkswagen group or something like Ford or GM, which has shared lots of different things across lots of different brands?
So I think what the issue is with sort of Ford and GM previously, they had, so Ford at one point, of course, had the, you know, what they call the premier automotive group. They had you know, they had Volvo and they had Saab ownership and all of those companies, like they gave them a lot more freedom. So I think with Volvo and, for example, they gave Volvo a lot more freedom to sort of do their own sort of infotainment systems, do their own sort of chassis work, and actually GM, which was which had sort of Saab ownership, Saab had a lot of freedom initially to have their own sort of, you know, platforms and chassis technologies and engine technologies. With Saab had like the, you know, biopower and twin power turbocharged. Saab had a focus on turbocharged engines, but with Hyundai and Kia, it's arguably a lot more aligned to what the MQB strategy is with Volkswagen and Skoda. So Volkswagen, Skoda and Seat to an extent, their entry level sort of mainstream models are all based on this sort of MQB platform, and they sort of, you know, they use the same fundamental toolkits, the same fundamental technologies, and then they have their own designers and they do their own sort of styling and own sort of interior design. Hyundai and Kia, at least in their sort of mainstream models, they're very, very sort of similar. So you have the i30 hatchback and the Cerato hatchback and sedan. They have a very, very sort of similar underpinning, same sort of powertrains with the i30 N line and the Kia Cerato GT. They share the sort of same 2-liter turbocharged engine. With the i30 sedan that Hyundai has just come out with, that's on a slightly different platform, like a newer generation, but they fundamentally, that's a very close relationship on a platform basis as well. Yep.
That's what I find quite interesting about Hyundai and Kia, is that the brands have a very similar market positioning. If you look at, mentioned Ford and GM, those are really good examples of companies where certain brands would be positioned as a little bit more premium than each other. And Hyundai Motor Group has got Genesis, but Hyundai and Kia brands seem to be on a very equal footing.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the more unique things in the automotive industry, because usually what happens is that you have like a budget brand and you have like a mainstream brand, and it's like a tiered structure. So, you know, with, as you mentioned, with Volkswagen and Skoda, you have Skoda as the sort of budget, the slightly more entry-level brand, although this is all relative given what, you know, you have Skoda coming out with models such as the new Octavia, and then they have the Superb, which, you know, are, you know, in any sort of, you know, everyday buyer sort of sense of mind, they're still very premium vehicles, you know. But Kia and Hyundai, I think the main differentiator is not necessarily the market positioning, which is very, very similar, but how their take on design. And it's one of the, I guess it goes to show the importance and the role that design can play in differentiating different brands. So Hyundai typically has a slightly more conservative approach, although, you know, with models such as the new Tucson, they've, you know, it's definitely, I wouldn't call it conservative at all. It's quite an eye-catching vehicle. And the same thing with Kia with the new Sportage. So Kia's traditionally had a sort of more sort of dynamic, sort of avant-garde design, but you know, they're both brands are going in their own separate directions, and I guess in some ways they want to maybe appeal to different types of buyers in some regards, at least.
As the world goes electric, we're going to see more platform sharing and more cars sharing parts. You've mentioned in your story the eGMP platform.
Yes.
What of that is shared, and what of that are we expecting to be differentiated between Hyundai and Kia?
So What we can see based on what Kia and Hyundai have come out with or have announced is that the underlying electrical architecture is very similar. So you have features like the 800-volt charging architecture, which allows, you know, very rapid charging at 350 kilowatts from, you know, from the tritium chargers, for example. You have very similar capabilities like the bidirectional charging. So Hyundai has announced with the IONIQ 5 that this will be one of the few electric vehicles that can output electricity as well. So say you're going on a camping trip, you can plug in like a, you know, plug in your tent or something, or not plug in your tent, but plug in like a generator or plug in an inverter, and the Kia can sort of, the Hyundai can sort of power that, or any sort of battery powered gadgets and everything. So the underlying, the fundamentals are quite similar. Where we can see the differences is maybe in the performance levels that they've announced so far. So you have Kia with the EV6, which is their sort of take on the EGMP platform. They've announced the EV6 GT, which has a lot more performance focus. So I think 0 to 100 in acceleration is less than 3.5 seconds that they've said. And Hyundai with the IONIQ 5 hasn't announced anything similar, but there's no reason why they can't in the future. So.
It's a really cool read. I would encourage you to have a more in-depth look at that piece. Vivek, you've also written some really other interesting stories. Can you just briefly just fill us in the past few weeks what you've written?
Sure. So I've been doing a series on badge histories as well. So that's the other series that I've been doing. So there's been a story on the history of German badges. So you have, you know, Opel, Porsche, Volkswagen, etc., BMW. And then before that, there was a series on Japanese marks as well. So you have the big five Japanese marks: Mitsubishi, Nissan, Subaru, Toyota, and Mazda as well. And so that's the most recent series. I've also previously done a series on Inside the Suppliers, which has been quite interesting to write about and definitely research as well.
Mm. You've been getting some great feedback, so we absolutely love your work, and we'll have to get you back on the podcast again soon. Vivek Shah, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Mandy, and thank you for having me on.
Saying goodbye to another Car Expert podcast this week. Events and launches, give us a rundown, please, Scully.
There's a fair bit happening at the moment as the world is opening up again for us Victorians and everyone in New South Wales gets on with life. Tony Crawford's actually been busy driving the Volkswagen Golf GTI today, the day we're talking. And then next week, we've got James Wong driving the Mercedes EQA 250, the electric little SUV, which will be very interesting. Mike Costello, who has just popped up on our screens, is off to talk to Great Wall Motors about the future of the brand. And I'm off to Sydney to learn a bit more about Cupra, the sexy Spanish Volkswagen brand. So
exciting.
There's a fair bit happening.
Fantastic. And what cars have we got coming through the garage, Will?
I should have checked this earlier because there's some stuff for me. Yay. So I've been in Sydney. I've been in Melbourne. I've been all over the place. But speaking of Melbourne, there will be a Mercedes-AMG GLA 35 and an Audi SQ2. Sounds like a comparison test is coming there. Also a Volkswagen T-Cross 85 TSI style and a Ford Puma ST Line V. It's also a Nissan Juke STL Plus, which slots in between the STL and the TI, sorry. In Sydney, there will be a Kia Rio Sport. And in Brisbane, Mazda CX-9 GT all-wheel drive, yes, and a Hyundai Tucson Elite 2-litre.
Fantastic. Lovely lineup there of cars. As always, thank you so much, Scott Colley and William Stopford. It's been fun.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.